Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened, happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason. Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
Horse?
You know Nurse Cole.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
Welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 2, The Lie. And what type of dog does your shirt say you love? Like old Hurley in this episode, my name is Dave Gonzalez and I heart chihuahuas.
My name is Joanna Robinson and I heart cats.
And I'm Neil Miller and I say I heart schnauzers. That's the t-shirt that I would have because there's 1.5 schnauzers that live in my household.
I mean, I guess I could pick a specific dog. Like I would say Vincent or Nico, Neil's
sure.
dog, but I don't have a breed. Anyway, that's my answer.
You're listening to a podcast about Lost. We are up through Season 5, Episode 2. We're skipping through time. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, there's a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. Then there's a second section that we call The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. Thank you so much for joining us this week. If you are an American and living in America, it has been tough because the government is openly hostile towards itself. So we're here to talk about television.
Speaking of hostile.
Oh yeah, it's good. The lost parallels continue. If you would like to support this show and it's continuing to tramp through Lost, no matter what happens in the real world, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you can figure out how to subscribe to us for a monthly rate that will also get you bonus content. You get access to our Slack. You could get bonus podcasts every week where Neil, Joanna, and I talk about other pop culture that is happening that is not Lost, which happened. And we have some bonus podcasts with Joanna, including Feels Like the First Time. Do we have any idea where Feels Like the First Time is going to head in these tumultuous times?
No.
Joanna Robinson.
Kristen suggested the genre of kids on bikes, which is something that we three talked about eons ago when we did our Stranger Things episode. The like Amblin Entertainment genre of kids on bikes. But she was like really amped when I brought up that concept to her. But I keep asking her about specific movies and she's seen them all. So I don't know if we can find a kids on bikes movie.
She's amped because she's into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Just all three ninjas movies.
Oh.
And you're good to go.
Do you know that I know one of the three ninjas? Have I told you that before?
Like personally?
Yeah. Like personally, like I grew up, like I used to be in carpool with him.
Is he still a ninja?
He was never a ninja. He's a white boy from Northern California. But he was once upon a time Stephanie Tanner's bad boyfriend on Full House. And then also he was in the final two from what he told it. I'm not sure if it's true, for John Connor in Terminator 2. So,
ooh.
Yeah.
Almost.
Anyway.
Edward Furlong.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost Edward Furlong, but forever a ninja.
Forever a ninja of the three ninjas.
If you want to hear more scintillating anecdotes like that, you can always hang out on our Patreon Slack, where we just like hang out and shoot the shit all day long amidst coups and everything else. You can go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers to join our Slack. And that is just like it's been a really cool community to watch grow and to know that they all have each other in these weird times. So, you know, I just want to say it has, I think, very little to do with us, how cool that community is. So, you know, if you're looking for a community right now, if you're feeling like lonely or isolated, that is a really, really cool one. They do stuff together all the time. If you want to get in contact with us, though, of course, you can always email us, host@stormpodcast.com. We got a bunch of new emails this week, a bunch of them like some juicy stormy ones, too. So we'll be reading those in the spoilery storm section and some for here in the calm. We do not have any new reviews this week. I kind of maybe like overshot it last week when I read all three, so now we have none. So if you want to leave us a review, that would be great. You can also visit our website, stormpodcast.com, to like hear the latest on what we will be watching or reading together, etc. This month in our Patreon supported movie club, I have picked Taika Waititi's film Hunt for the Wilder People, which is sort of freshly on Netflix. So that will be fun to watch together at the end of the month. And you can always go to twitter.com/stormpodcast to vote on like our Jungle Kissery polls and other things. And if you are in our Patreon support Slack, you do this Saturday get to watch the next episode, Jughead, with Dave during our Lost live group watch.
It's Riverdale crossover time, guys.
I was about to ask commies what they think the title of the episode means. So if you have any theories of what Jughead means, don't Google it, for goodness sakes, but I would love to hear it. Okay, let us get to some emails. Let's start with, you might remember, this is the ongoing saga of Myriad Six. You might remember that we had a reviewer last week that needed some tech support. I told them to email me. They did on Sunday, 2 days ago, and I still have not responded to them. So I'm sorry, Tony, I got your email. I will send you that tech support. But Tony also wrote a sort of origin story, so I'll read it right now. I remember when Lost first came out, I was uninterested as I was under the impression that it was based on the reality show Survivor, which I had never been interested in watching. In October 2006, I ended up having an appendectomy, and because I was uninsured at the time, they gave me the cheap surgery, an open appendectomy with a big incision as opposed to the laparoscopic. And I had a couple weeks of recovery where I was so sore that I couldn't even leave my apartment building as there were several steps to get in and it was too painful. One of my roommates offered to get me some DVDs from Blockbuster to pass the time, and since I kept hearing about Lost, I figured I'd finally give it a try. Well, needless to say, I was immediately drawn in from that amazing pilot episode. Every couple days, I made my roommate go back to Blockbuster for several more Lost DVDs, and I effectively binged the first two seasons before binge culture existed. When I got through those seasons, I streamed a few episodes of season 3 on the ABC website to catch up and was excited to finally watch the episodes live. I have to say, although I loved reading all the forums and theories and listening to the official podcast, I think I really always have had the fondest memory of seasons 1 and 2, in part because I was able to binge them. Once I started the live week-to-week watches, I often found myself spoiled by theories I read online and felt I enjoyed it a little less. I know it's a little heretical to say that to a podcast that originally titled Storm of Spoilers. Anyway, Dave, please don't tighten it up. And Joanna, I'll always follow you through the JPU, Joanna Podcast Universe, as another reviewer once put it, Tony. So thank you, Myriad Six. Do you guys have a show that you ever like binged on DVDs that required like frequent trips to the video store?
I made several people watch the first season of 24 that way, and then they may or may not have then been addicted and continued to do that, renting up a storm in such a way. But it was like there was a transition right to when like you could get like DVD sets of entire seasons of shows and just be like, woo! Like, I remember it was a big deal when we got our first seasons, a Simpsons DVD box set. Anyway, not important. Neil?
It was like a window of time, like an early aughts window of time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's where mine comes from as well, because it was Battlestar Galactica. And I remember the first, I had never watched it, and the first season came out on Blu-ray for the first time. And so somebody, they sent
that piano
me,
themed on all the menus.
Yeah. They sent me the box set and I watched it and I was like, oh shit, now I want to watch the rest of it. So it ended with me like buying one season at a time, like going to like Best Buy and like buying it as they had it in stock to like get all the seasons of Battlestar Galactica to catch up to, I think, the final season. I think it was right before the fourth season. So yeah, I've been there. But shout out to that roommate for doing the real,
I know,
out there doing the islands,
yeah,
work.
The legwork.
For me, I think it was I randomly caught a Doctor Who marathon on Sci-Fi where they were showing episodes like out of order, and it was like, you know, it was sometime in the David Tennant run, though late in the David Tennant run, and it inspired me to like go to the video store and pick up all, like, going back to Christopher Eccleston and starting from there. So I definitely did like a, yep, I'm back again. I would like the next Doctor Who disc, please. All right, we got an email from Jennifer, who's doing a little public service announcement. This is inspired by Myriad Six's review, where Jennifer says, hey guys, I was listening to the review you were reading from Myriad Six and noticed the reviewer complaining about paying for Hulu. Not sure if you all discussed where Lost is available or not, but I watch it for free on IMDb TV. Just thought I'd bring it up in case some listeners weren't aware. So I think you can watch it, like, I think it's ad-supported on IMDb
yeah,
TV,
it has.
But
commercials.
Yeah. So you can watch it there with commercials if you're not like streaming along with us on Saturdays or whatever. So, and some folks watch it with commercials, even, you know, they figured out how to stream with us anyway. So that's just an option if you are looking to tighten your belts in pandemic times. All right. This email comes from Jack and he says, dear fearless leaders, I have a potentially stormy question. Don't worry. I read it. It's not, I don't think it's stormy. Can you think of a non-convenient reason of why Desmond only remembers the Dan interaction in 2007-2008? In my mind, he should remember it within the same time of when it happened to Dan. Dan interacts with Hatch Desmond a day or so after the island moved. So my thinking is that Desmond should have this new memory within a day or two after the island moved. Hope that all makes sense. Thoughts? Jack, does that make sense, that question?
I think is in line with what my assumptions were, is that the memory doesn't occur to Desmond until Dan does it, which is in the future, which is why Desmond doesn't know when we previously meet him, you know, when we're,
that's not the question, that's not Jack's question. Jack's question is like, why does Desmond only remember it by 2007-2008, not in 2004, right after, or 2005, whenever, right after he gets off the island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's because it doesn't happen until after he gets off the island.
No. Sorry, I'm doing a bad job explaining.
No, he's
it.
Saying
Dave,
that,
Dave,
like,
can you explain?
So if the frozen donkey wheel is turned on day zero, then if in linear Dan time, he talks to Desmond on, like, day one, and Desmond doesn't remember until 3 years after day zero.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So it's like the memory itself is part of like this weird
oogly-googly time
that we have going
on. Oh, maybe it took the same route that the freighter doctor took to the island.
Well,
that's,
yeah, I mean,
the same
so
route that memory took.
It to, had to leave to,
the
island.
Suckhole.
Yeah.
It was on the wrong bearing. The memory was on the wrong bearing, and that's why it took 3 to 4 years. I think it's an inconsistency, but you know,
that's fair.
It's fine.
It's island magic.
Yeah, like I think it makes sense why Desmond wouldn't have always remembered it, as you were saying, Neil, before Dave did a better year zero explanation than I was doing. but I don't think it makes sense that it took 3 or 4 years to get to him. So unless we decide that it's the memory was on the wrong bearing, which I'm fine with. So
sure.
We have another email. I think it's a storm email, but we have another email that's like telling us in a polite way to sort of like stop worrying about understanding all the rules, which is fair. Anyway, go ahead.
That is very fair.
Yeah.
If it's like everything's skipping on a record, right? And they're able to, we see in this episode, like take certain things with them. I feel like Dan has the memory and he gives it to Desmond, but then he's literally flashing out of it when it happens. So like the memory skips off the record in a different place from Dan. That's the only way that I could make myself feel better about it. But it's a real Hitchhiker's Galaxy type waving of the hand through a metaphor. So I don't feel good about it.
It's funny that in this episode, Juliet is talking about what you can bring through time. Because like as she was doing it, I was like, oh yeah, the throw your body on a stack of beer. We already talked about that. That's fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The old throw your body on a stack of beer conundrum.
It could have worked. It could have worked.
Okay. We've got just two more emails. This one comes from Marlon, who writes, I wanted to question the true purpose of the lie, the titular lie in this episode. My question is, who does the lie really protect? Both Jack and Locke believe the lie is to protect the island, but doesn't it only protect Charles Widmore? My theory is that if the Oceanic Six had told the truth as Hurley wanted, it would have only exposed the lie that Widmore told or concocted when he faked the plane wreckage. The island itself was protected when Ben moved it, which Hurley said. Telling the lie only protects Widmore from his crimes of grave robbery, fraud, and conspiracy to commit murder, a la sending the mercenaries to kill anyone in the island. If the Oceanic Six had told the truth, wouldn't Widmore have gone to prison, especially if Frank testified to Widmore's connection to the freighter and the mercenaries? That's from Marlon.
I feel like yes, it saves Widmore, but also it is like, hey, there's a magical island out there, like for sure. Like what Hurley says on the boat in this episode, like they'll believe all of them if they all come forward and say it. That makes it somewhat truthy. So it's not so much protecting the island from specifically Charles Widmore, who's not going to stop. I don't think it doesn't look like he's going to stop, but from anyone.
From anyone else who would want to find the magical island of mystery. If a bunch of people, yeah. The kooks and the credulous scientists and whatever.
That doesn't make me feel better with, like, you know, the Oceanic Six being like, and Claire is probably fine over there. We're protecting her. Because I feel like that isn't true. But I would think that that's who they're protecting it from. They're just protecting the island.
I guess I would be more comfortable with the lie if what they immediately got to work to do was to try to get back. I know that I know that that's like the whole thing, that it just takes some time for Jack to grow a beard and decide that that's what you have to do. But like, isn't, you know, we talked about this before, I think, with Saeed, where it's just sort of like the Saeeds and Hurleys, at least. I think wouldn't be like, I'm going to marry Nadia and be fine. They'd be like, hey, we know people on an island somewhere. Can we figure out a way to get to them? Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Hurley's like, I'm a millionaire.
Yeah.
And I could be probably doing something.
Yeah. Ask Penny for all of her research and she would give it to you. And you would have to just like ignore all the Christmas doodles in the margin. And then eventually, like, you know, use Hurley's resources and find it. Anyway, all right, this last email comes from a listener named Jan, who gave me permission to try out the email in a German accent, spelled A-K-Z-E-N-T, and I decided not to. But thank you for the permission, Jan. All right. Hi, guys. Thanks to mostly working from home during the current lockdown here in Germany, I had the time to finally start rewatching Lost on DVD several years after the last time I watched it. It was a lot of fun reveling in all of season one's 2004 glamour, including those crazy bad polygons, while browsing through the coffee table glory of the Lost Encyclopedia. But when I took a break at the beginning of season two, I wondered if there was maybe a podcast about the series to accompany my rewatch project. Turned out there was, and thankfully still is. But being the Teutonic perfectionist I sometimes am, of course I had to catch up on all of your episodes first, until finally reaching season 5's first episode, both on DVD and at your podcast, realigning the respective timelines, so to speak. I'm immensely enjoying the now time-tested awards and corners. Not a Twitter person myself, but there's anything that might make me actually start using my account, it would be voting for the hashtag Jungle of Kistery. Which also highlight the fun all three of you seem to have doing all of this. I simply love the dynamics between the three of you, especially Joanna's fantastic interviews, Dave's takes on Locke's possible antagonist status, and Neil's here's a theory approaches. At the same time, all hilarity connected to Wet Walt theories notwithstanding, I especially enjoy your in-depth takes on aspects like depictions of gender, culture, and race seen from a critical 2020 perspective, while staying appreciative of the show's achievements. Finally, although I did not watch the show right from the beginning when it first aired, it remains a real classic and an emotional powerhouse that made me laugh and bawl to almost equal degrees. So thank you for providing us with your fun and insightful takes on Lost. I probably do not have to stress how important it is in trying times like ours to be able to still enjoy things like a classic television show while not just surrendering to blind escapism, and your podcast shows us an excellent way to do that in the best way possible. All the best from Hamburg, not the one in Pennsylvania, nor the one in New Jersey, and keep up the fantastic work, Jan. So, thank you, Jan. And yeah, that's essentially a review, not so. We do have a review. We just came in an email form, and from Germany. it got here faster than a memory to Desmond. So thank you so much. And those are all our calm emails. We've got a couple of fun stormy ones, so we will revisit those in the storm section. But first, Neil Miller, what happened on Lost this week?
Well, this week's episode of Lost, The Lie, was directed by Jack Bender, written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. This episode aired right after episode one on January 21st, 2009. They aired back to back. This episode, of course, continues to take place on the island. But first, off the island, we learn that Hurley originally argued against the Oceanic Six lie, and despite the fact that he and Saeed disagreed, we flash forward to 3 years later, where Hurley is keeping an unconscious Saeed safe and driving like a madman across Los Angeles. As Hurley tries to keep Saeed alive and evade their would-be captors, he gets some help, both from his parents and ghost Ana Lucia. Elsewhere, off the island, Kate takes Aaron and seeks help from Sun, who apparently doesn't blame her for what happened to Jin. And as Ben finds a place to keep John Locke's body safe, Jack is called in by Hurley to take Saeed to the hospital and wake him up, all while Hurley tells his mom the truth about what happened on the island. Later on, Ben shows up at Hurley's house to make a recruiting pitch for returning to the island that leaves one hot pocket splattered on the wall and Hurley running into the open arms of the police. Great job, Ben. Back on the island, our remaining survivors struggle to start over as Dan tries to triangulate their position in time. Before he can do that, however, the camp is attacked by flaming arrows, and many, if not all, of the remaining unnamed survivors of Flight 815 are killed. R.I.P. Frogert. In the aftermath, Sawyer and Juliet are briefly captured by a mysterious group of soldiers before being rescued by a knife-wielding John Locke. The whole thing ends in a secret location that is new to us. As a pendulum swings back and forth and math equations litter the walls, a mysterious woman makes entries into a Dharma-style computer. When Ben Linus shows up to speak with her, she tells him that he has 70 hours left to do whatever it is that he's trying to do. Fun fact for you about this episode, the Shih Tzu t-shirt that Hurley wears bears the image of Edward Kitsis' dog, Stuart. So that's a... that's a little Easter egg tidbit. This week's question, I don't want to say I'm a fan of Hot Pockets because I've seen that Jim Gaffigan bit where he makes fun of them, and that made me feel shame, but I've eaten a few Hot Pockets in my life. And I think I like the breakfast ones. They're pretty solid, like the sausage, egg, and cheese. But do you guys, are you Hot Pocket connoisseurs at all, and if so, do you have a favorite Hot Pocket flavor?
Can I just really quickly say that I know that Dave is, because Dave, didn't you tell us the other week that you had just like scalded the roof of your mouth
and he was gonna eat a second one? That's right.
I feel like this is like has been prep for this.
Yeah, all right, so we'll start with Dave.
Ahead, Joanne. Okay, but we'll start with me. Yes, I currently have Hot Pockets in my freezer. I like very fast ways of consuming the calories I need to keep moving, and Hot Pockets are very good for that. But that being, I'm pretty basic bitch with it. I got the premium pepperoni. That's the way I go.
Okay.
Basically only that.
D, Dave Android check-in. Like, whenever Dave talks about, like, consuming food units. I've never had the breakfast ones. I bet they're good.
Yeah.
I'm actually, contrary to my usual approach to life, honestly, I'm actually a lean pocket fan. I really like, there's a turkey. I mean, I haven't had them in a very long time, but when I had Hot Pockets, it was like a, there's like a turkey, cheese, and broccoli one that I really liked. So, yes, microwave broccoli in a low-calorie cheese sauce.
Yeah, I do think it's been quite a while since I've had a Hot Pocket. But,
I'm not knocking Dave's Hot Pockets. I, you know, if someone showed up with a box of cheese and turkey and broccoli Hot Pockets to my door, I would eat one. But, one of our listeners pointed out in that scene where Hurley's making a Hot Pocket, something like, you're never going to crisp up if you don't use the sleeve. Like, what is Hurley doing nuking that Hot Pocket without the sleeve?
I have an idea, mm-hmm. which is that's the thing that makes it a trademark Hot Pocket. So that's the thing you can't put on screen.
That's funny.
If it is obviously a Hot Pocket, because we all know what it is, but doesn't have the trademark crisping sleeve, it could just be,
Hot Pocket.
Calzone log?
Hot Pocket.
I like calzone. anyway. So let's stick off island for a while, because we got a thrilling Hurley episode, which are, you know, not necessarily two things that always go together. Sometimes Hurley episodes are like emotional swan songs, but we always like them. I was just thinking about the VW bug there. I wouldn't say Dave is an emotional swan song, but we get more Cheech. We get back to Casa de Hurley. We get him attempting to get Saeed back into the hands of Jack, and something that it was very hard not to just make the opening of the podcast every week, but one of my favorite scenes of the season is Hurley explains Lost, which is great.
About as well as anyone would at this point who's been watching.
Yeah, really. If you had to off the top of your head explain Lost up to this point, you could do pretty well just by copying what Hurley gets to say. Though not nearly enough questions asked about, you know, Electro Waltz and mysterious horses, but he has
there was this kid Walt. We forgot about him.
Yeah. Some things we forgot about.
I want to talk about that because I want to revisit that thing you said last week, Dave, about Lost being led by the nose of a plot rather than character. Not to like, yeah. I'm not bringing it back up to be like an I told you so or sort of thing, but I just want to like maybe better articulate it than I did last week and say, you know, this is a Hurley centric episode, which seems like a hard thing to do in this new era of Lost where we're checking in with everyone, right? To call it a Hurley episode, because mm-hmm. we have to like check in everywhere. We see what's, you know, we see Jack and Saeed and Ben and et cetera, et cetera. And Kate and Son, everyone, like we see all the six, right? But it is emotionally a Hurley episode. It's not surprising to me that Kitsis and Horowitz wrote it, because they wrote all the Hurley episodes, as far as I know. In last week's episode, I was thinking more about it, even though like on like the wiki and stuff like that, it's sort of jokingly referred to as the, I don't know what we're calling him at this point.
The Dr. Chang the episode.
Dr. Marvin Chang episode.
Yeah, sure. That's more Sawyer's episode, I think, actually. Because he has sort of the emotional lead of the episode when he talks about, or it could be a Dan episode, but like it strikes me as more of a Sawyer episode, because Sawyer was like really sidelined in season 4, and here we watch him, like, he's got the main emotional beat of this episode when he's talking about you know, jumping out of the helicopter and thinking everyone's dead and stuff like that, you know? And so I think making sure to find these moments, and in the Hurley one, it's so deft, as is often the case with a Hurley episode, where Jorge Garcia swings between comedy of recapping Lost for us, high comedy, and like incredible emotion in the same speech to his mom. and like really, really brings that emotional core, that character driven core of the show into it all, you know?
Yeah. And I like bonus points for the characters of Hurley's mom, obviously, for believing him at the drop of a hat, and for the All Daves, who manages to kind of not bad dad this one up.
Yeah, he's a good dad for one episode.
All it took was like a body he had to hide. Maybe he just understood that more than he understood like nebulous fears.
Cheech just needed some wacky hijinks, and then he's like, I'm in. I'm Cheech. I can do this. So, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, David Reyes is one of my favorite dads, because he's not like, I guess Jin's dad is the only like really, really solid, good gold dad, right? Mm-hmm. Unless I'm missing one, but David is like a complicated dad. On the path of redemption, dad, sort of thing.
He at least, yeah, he seems to be making positive steps in a positive direction. And if we don't want to, you know, hold somebody accountable for the worst moments in their life, we don't really know what happened to Dave. He lost Libby too. You know, that's gotta hurt. Sorry, guys. If you haven't been listening to the podcast, we had a joke that everybody who was named Dave could possibly be the same Dave, being as Hurley's imaginary friend Dave could have possibly been built out of an idea in his head, because his dad, you know, hands him a candy bar and goes away, and then we never see Libby's Dave, but she does end up in.
Could you say all Daves are one Dave theory? Mm-hmm. I think that that evokes it, right?
Well, I mean, if you've been listening to the podcast the whole time, otherwise, I wanted to make sure that everybody was caught up with this.
Don't want
I will
people to get lost
Cheech
in the Dave vortex.
There's one episode where Dave shows up with Neil, and we are in it. I'm going to make the most of it.
And poor Joanna's corpse still.
Sure.
Poor Joanna's corpse
R.I.P. somewhere at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, the benefit for Joanna is that she didn't have to get live. She didn't live long enough to get hit by a flaming arrow. So I honestly think that she did okay. I mean, I think it was probably okay that she didn't make it this far.
That is, I mean, okay, I don't want to, I want to spend the second half of the podcast on the island, because I do think not only is it action-packed, we have a lot of questions, but sticking here with our characters, their Oceanic Six off-island, I don't think, because we didn't watch these episodes together, but they did air together, I don't think I really got until the end of this episode how much Jack's character has become amenable to somebody else calling the shots. Ben throws out his pills and tells him basically what to do and where to go these days. Obviously, he's going to do some freestyle doctoring when Saeed shows up, but according to Lostopedia, he injects the adrenaline in the wrong place. So, still just average Jack doctoring. But I do think it's interesting how, in terms of, he always needed to be the leader. He was yelling at Kate that he needs to go back, but now that Ben showed up and seems to have a core plan, even if that plan is confusing to him, he's all in.
So you said amenable to someone telling him what to do. Would you say amenable to coercion? Is that what you're saying?
Hmm. Yeah. Possibly.
Like another
possibly
character
coercion. Oh, I don't know who you could be talking about. The guy who murders somebody by throwing a knife into his back later on in the part of the episode we're going to talk about later? In the part of the episode we're going to talk about later? So Ben's hands and tendrils have ensnared Jack. I would say if we're making teams, that Jack is pretty squarely on Team Ben. And we also discover that Ben, much like he has a hotel room standing in Tunisia, has a creepy butcher lady who is totally up for keeping bodies for him. That seems weird, right?
You don't have personal butcher shop with a Jill who will hide bodies for you?
Get we on don't my, all get have on my
Colorado. Yeah. Everyone here in this state just pretends to be elk hunting and puts their bodies in the garage fridge.
Yeah. Well, if we're doing teams, let's do all the teams, right? So it's Ben and Jack. It's Hurley and Saeed.
Ben and
And yeah. It's Kate and Son, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of where we are?
That's what it appears to be. And it seems like Kate and Son, we know Son has some revenge on her mind, and Kate gets some, you know, good counseling from Son that this person's probably not going to go public. It's just the blood test was a threat to either provoke a reaction out of Kate or to make her do something done. But Son's got that under control. We know Team Ben, very specifically from the end of the episode, also involves Mrs. Hawking, and they need to get back to the island. So Team Ben is get back to the island. Team Sun and Kate are self-preservationists after Ben.
Do you want to explain to our listeners who might not know who Mrs. Hawking, where we've seen Mrs. Hawking on the show before? Because a bunch of our commies are really confused. They didn't remember her when she showed up.
Ah, yes. Yes, yes. Mrs. Hawking is the person who showed up in Desmond's dream / time traveling in Flashes Before Your Eyes that told him that he could not change things. If you might remember, she watched a gentleman get crushed by some bricks, and that was her example. She's like it seemed like some sort of dream guide that knew about Desmond, and that's where we saw her. But apparently also very real, as this episode reveals at the very end. And working on a Dharma computer with a station logo we don't recognize, and a giant pendulum that's drawing chalk lines in the Pacific Ocean.
There you go. I mean,
hey,
she's here. She's
yeah.
She's here. She's a real lady.
you have to bleep that, Dave. You have to bleep it. I did almost so well.
She seems to at least be working with Team Ben as well. I guess I don't know. We don't know what team she's on, but she's, you know, doing some dealings with Ben here. You know.
She's once again in the position where she knows the consequences, apparently. She's our rule setter for this, I don't know, stakes. Not rule setter, because I don't know if we could trust her yet. She set our stakes. We got 70 hours, we got our ticking clock, and what happens if it goes bad? Like, God help us all. This lady is very scared about it.
Yeah.
Can we zoom back to that Son and Kate conversation?
Yes, let's.
This is one of the most memorable scenes to me always, because every time I watch it, I'm so terrified of Sun in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yujin Kim, like, her performance in this scene is so good, very multi-layered. She tells Kate she doesn't blame her, but at the same time, if I were Kate, I would be like losing my mind with what Sun is saying here. So it's so hard to tell whether or not Sun is genuinely supporting Kate in this scene, or whether or not Sun's actually the one behind the scary lawyer who came to Kate's house. You know what I mean? Like, it's to me, every time I watch it, even though I know the answer, every time I watch it, it's unclear to me. And I think that's down to good writing and a great performance. Mm-hmm. Do you guys get that vibe off that scene at all, or? I don't know.
It definitely seems sinister. Yeah, yeah. In terms of, we've seen Sun, like, assert herself so far, and that's been fun because it's against dudes of power that we enjoy seeing her assert herself against. But yeah, once you put her back with the Oceanic Six and it's not Hurley holding a baby, then yeah, I don't know how to necessarily feel about her or know what her position is.
Yeah.
She's got a real Walter White quality to her.
I mean, if I were her, I would blame Kate, but she says she doesn't, so that's what I mean. I don't know.
Well, also, if you blame somebody, you don't tell them to your face, right? That seems like the climax of your thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Games and circles, and the only one who I could convince is actually saying the thing he wants to say every time he talks is Hurley, which is, you know, why I think he makes a good anchor for this episode. And why also Joanna outlined it earlier, that exact same point. All right, cool. Do we have any other off-island business before we jump back onto the island and talk about the craziness that goes on there? Oh wait, no,
oh yeah,
wait,
oh yeah, we do.
There's a dry ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a dry early sees Anna Lucia. Sorry, Anna Lucia. Almost forgot about you. In my mind, I guess that happens at the end of last episode, but it doesn't. It happens in this episode at the very top. This is another example of Hurley seeing somebody who died on the island, off the island, and I guess our wet dries rules are kind of blowing up as we get further into season 5.
But I also just don't.
But
I
this,
just, I, like, this, okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. This one's a lot more like Charlie in that it also acknowledges that it's dead.
But she doesn't say if I were alive. She said if I were real. Which to me was like, is, you know, like, because Charlie, are we supposed to believe that's actually the ghost of Charlie, or is that just the manifestation of Hurley something or other? And then someone else sees Charlie, so then we're supposed to be like, okay, what's, I mean, I don't know what any of that means. And once again, it sort of feels like some, like a slightly sloppy thing that the show does, not with like rules of ghosts, but like conflating mental illness with like supernatural abilities, because the other person who sees Charlie isn't another patient at the mental institution. So like, you know, oh, if you are mentally unstable, you can see ghosts. I don't know.
And then how do we extend that to Jack and his pill addiction and him seeing his father all the time?
Right. It's messy. But with Anna Lucia saying if I were real, maybe she just means like if I were really a real cop who was alive and not a dead cop as I am. I don't know. It just seemed it seemed like a weird choice of words to me.
Well, I would also see that in Hurley, you know, I don't want to say mental illness triggers hallucinations, but the dude is being chased by assassins and probably the police, and his badass friend who could kill people with his ankles is passed out in the car. If he had to, like, you know, have his left brain talk to his right brain subconsciously, and he needed to trigger somebody, like his mind pulling Annalisa out of his memory to give him the cops talking to, does make sense to me, which is why I don't feel like this is bad. It's just mysterious.
Well, I don't think it's bad. I love this moment. Like, I love that Michelle Rodriguez agreed to do it. Not just that she agreed to come back to the show, but like a lot of people at the time I was reading, you know, concurrent recaps, a lot of people at the time saw this as like a nod to her DUI as well. Which hadn't occurred to me when we watched this
interesting
weekend, but was sort of like how people read it, which I thought was interesting. Whether or not that was the intention, that was sort of the impression that it gave. And I think I love her in this episode.
Yeah, it's a fun scene. Here's a fun fact about it. It has been exactly 42 episodes since we've seen Anna Lucia.
Hey, that's a number.
If you're looking for some.
Anna Lucia's in this episode.
But I like it. And I think there's one other thing that when she says, you know, Libby says hi, that one is another one that sort of pushes toward the maybe this is something that's happening in Hurley's head situation in my mind. You know, because, you know, Hurley would go to that. But how do we know that Anna Lucia and Libby would really hang out as ghosts? I don't think we do.
I also want to wonder, like, I mean, did they maybe want to get Cynthia Watrous to do this and couldn't, so they got Michelle Rodriguez? Do you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
If Hurley's going to see a ghost, is it more likely to be Cynthia Watrous? I mean, obviously the cop stuff only works if it's Anna Lucia, but...
Yeah.
Also, before we get on island, I want to talk about the mom stuff in this episode. We get Son and Kate talking about being moms, and then we get Hurley's mom, obviously. And there just hasn't been, you know, there's so much bad dad stuff in Lost, as we talk about all the time. But this idea of mom, good mom stuff or mom stuff in general is kind of rare, I think. And I think that's down to, like, you know, the bad dad stuff, as we've talked about over and over again, it has a lot to do with Damon Lindelof exercising his own demons about his own relationship with his father. So it's very much like a son's contemplation of parenthood. But I didn't do the math on when Damon Lindelof had his son, but like, I don't know, maybe now he's starting to tell from a parental point of view, those kinds of stories. You know what I mean? Maybe I can find out when the son was, you know what I mean? But like, I think you can tell parental stories even if you don't have kids, but I think you're going to be more interested in telling stories about being a parent once you are a parent yourself versus like remembering being a son, if that makes any sense. So,
I think that makes sense.
Having grown up with other podcasters, friends of mine who have had children, I could say like, yeah. They have this whole level of chat where they like talk about movies that have scenes with babies in peril in them. And they're like, watch out for this one. And I'm like, ah, ha, 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 Perry Mason's funny. I'm kidding. I didn't think Perry Mason was funny, but that just a whole different perspective. If you want to, I think we had Patches talking about that very specific thing on season one of this podcast with Lost. All right. Finally, we're back to the skipping record island and everything that happens on it, including the most featured of Neil Frogert that the show will ever have.
I mean, we knew we were going to get to Neil, a.k.a. Frogert, at some point, you know? Our namesakes are all in this, and he shows up. He is the worst. He dies by flaming arrow. Honestly, it's a good showing for a terrible Neil.
Do you know that? Sorry, go ahead.
I picture him slipping in, like, once Sawyer became Sheriff Sawyer, I bet Neil was like, you know, now that there's, like, not a big asshole, I bet I could push a little bit more of my personality. And I bet as soon as Sawyer, like, traipsed off into the jungle, Neil just got intolerable. Like, I think we haven't heard from Neil yet because they've been able to hold Neil in check. But, like, with a beach camp without a Jack or a Sawyer for too long, it lets Frogert run wild.
Yeah, real, I mean, eventually real, someone...
real Earth vibes here.
Yeah. Right. Eventually someone's going to try and fill that power vacuum, and it's going to be the wrong person.
All right, I have some background on Neil, a.k.a. Mm-hmm. Frogert, if you want it.
Let's do it.
So Neil Frogert, I guess, was a running joke on the online Lost fan culture. And he was first mentioned by Carlton and Damon on their podcast 2006. And then he got like they reference him in the show, but it was like a running joke that the producers, the showrunners had. They made a little, I don't like the word mobisode, which is why I don't like to mention it.
Mobile
episode. He got a mobile episode, for like it, that they did to promote season four. And in it, he is really crusty and cranky and bitchy towards Hurley because Neil Frogert has a crush on Libby. So he's mad that she's giving Hurley attention. So if you needed any more reason to not like Neil, he was unkind about Hurley. So you know he has to die.
And he was probably creeping with Libby, let's be honest.
So that's like the full ballad of Neil. But I have some other things to say about Lost, and because this is the biggest culling of the non-named cast members we've seen, bigger even than Kimi's attack on Dharmaville last season, which also culled a bunch of non-named cast members. Does that sound accurate to you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So between the attack on Dharmaville and the Fire Arrow attack, that takes most of the other, I think it's 38, No, that's too many. Anyway, the extra non-named cast members. In an interview, Damon Lindelof said The show is now moving into a phase where the presence of the socks, and I'll get to that in a second, presence of the socks was no longer directly necessary, so we killed them with arrows, and that's just what you do. They did not call their expendables red shirts. They called them meat socks. Because they're like, red shirts belongs to Star Trek, so on Lost we call them meat socks. So, yeah. Sorry, go ahead. I have more to say, but...
That... Oh, no, no, no. Keep going, because I have the capper to your meat socks is our official podcast check-in.
So the middle... Oh, let me make sure I'm not spoiling anything from the official podcast check-in. They mentioned the socks. Okay. So originally, when they pitched the show, when Damon and JJ pitched the show... ABC wanted it to be the survivors and then seven additional background cast members. But then they finally convinced ABC to allow them to expand the background cast to 33. So they'd have a total of 48 survivors. And something that, like, you know, some of the, like, diehard fans who are listeners and members of our Patreon Slack community have pointed out that, like, these act, unlike a lot of shows that would use background actors, Lost used the same, not always the same, but often the same recurring people milling around in the background of the island. We've talked about Rugby Shirt Girl before and stuff like that, right? So, like, they would use the same others and the same island survivors and stuff like that. So that was, like, to sort of give this... you know, vibe of, like, this is actually real and happening. So I think that's interesting. Okay. And so then here's a quote, though. Here's an interesting, so, but originally Damon had a different idea of what they were going to do with these, meat socks. So here's an interview that he gave back in season one. He said, JJ and I decided to have 48 people survive because we wanted to stock the show with as many possible story avenues as possible. As I recall, the network tried to talk about us out of it. Greatest thing about the other castaways is that they can come forward for an episode and they'll melt back into the chorus. The popular thinking is that their function is purely to be red shirts, and that's grossly mistaken. In fact, we've always loved the idea that one of our series regs goes traipsing off into the jungle with one of the castaways we've never seen before. The audience is thinking the poor Yahoo with one line is going to die a gruesome and horrible death, but then it's the regular who gets wiped out. It will be done. Watch and see. To my knowledge, this was never done. Can you recall if this was ever done? Like, Arntz is the one who dies in the jungle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I in terms of bringing background people forward, that's the Nikki and Paolo experiment. But can you think of an instance where, like, say, a Jin and a Scott Steve goes into the jungle and Jin doesn't come back? Like, I can't think of one.
I love this idea that Lost is like, we're going to be a show that unexpectedly kills our main characters. And it's like, mostly not. we'll get locked dead by the end of season five. But, like, he had five seasons.
No, I can't think of... I mean, the closest... And this doesn't count because it's when Ben and Roger go off. It's like one of the early times we actually meet Roger. But that's still... He's a very named character at this point. No, I can't think of any time. Maybe it's hidden in season six somewhere and we just haven't.
Yeah, maybe. The last, and then he gave another interview like after season one, but he's still on this idea, but he goes, that's what's great about Lost. One of our regular characters can go out into an exposition with two people you haven't seen. Then the regular gets killed. The other two come back, and now they're regulars. So we certainly want to keep the audience guessing. There's a reason that in addition to the 14 regulars, there are 33 other characters who survived the crash. They're not just monster food. P.S. They're just monster food. Or spider bait.
It feels like a real J.J. Abrams, like, part of his initial pitch was, and then we kill the main character. And then Michael Keaton said no, and so they were like, well, we should still kill a main character, though.
Anyway, I just thought that was interesting because, like, he just said it in, like, multiple interviews. He's like, we're gonna do this, watch and see. And I'm like, ooh, in the end, who survives the arrow attack? Why, it is James and Juliet and Dan and Charlotte. You know, they found other ways to inject new characters. We've got freighter people, we've got Desmond, we've got the others and stuff like that. But you know, it's interesting to me, this great culling of the other survivors. There are
Joanna got a name. That's how much effort they were willing to put into the background characters in season one.
And then Boone goes out swimming to save her. And then Boone drowns, but Joanna swims back. Surprise. Anyway, so there's no knock on that. We all have ideas that we don't execute, but I just thought it was really funny that he talked it up a lot and I never did it. There are a few background survivors. Survived the flaming arrow attack, but not many. So, and then there were like 12 or whatever.
Speaking of, let's figure out who those important ones are with our official podcast check-in. Lost had an official podcast that would air along with episodes in between episodes. They'd put it up on ABC. They'd also distribute it like a podcast. This particular one had no listener questions. It was very short, and they just wanted to answer some questions from the two-part premiere and tease Jughead, and this part seemed important for us to know. So Neil will be reading Damon Lindelof, and I will be reading Carlton Cuse.
So obviously, Sawyer and Juliet go off, go sort of running off after this this arrow attack, you know. And then we also have Faraday and Miles and Charlotte, who I assume nothing bad happened to in the arrow attack, or else you would have made a bigger deal out of it. So what happened to Rose and Bernard and the rest of the Sox? Are we to understand that they all have been massacred?
I think, sadly, a lot of the Sox died and perished. It was a very effective flaming arrow attack, and I think a lot of them went down. However, Rose and Bernard, I think, are probably safe. If the rules are constant, then they would have traveled wherever Sawyer and Juliet and the rest of them went, but obviously, they're just not in that exact same geographic space, but I would venture to say that they're probably in the same time.
So
and scene. So Rose and Bernard.
Rose and Bernard and Miles and Charlotte and Dan and Sawyer James and Juliet, Juliet and John.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's not Froger.
Not you,
and
Neil.
Not Froger.
Good riddance.
Join me in the dead pile, Neil.
Yeah.
Only hashtag Dave lives.
I said we can't all be the infinite Dave.
Dave will go on. Yeah, it's gonna be sweet. All right, and I think also a thing to bring up here is before Flaming Arrow attack and before Frogert is annoying and gets shot by a flaming arrow. We see that Dan stumbles out of the forest, saying he lost his backpack, needs to determine where we are in time, and has a conversation with Charlotte that seems to concern Dan very much. That probably has a lot to do with her nosebleed, similar to her nosebleed.
Yeah, the and nosebleed she's having a headache, too.
Memory issues and headache.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds like some time sickness.
Is that what we call? I was trying to remember exactly what we called it last
time.
Time
disease.
Time disease.
Time disease sounds like Lyme disease. It's great.
Yes, the old time disease.
The old
You've been
time disease.
Bit by a time tick, and now you have time disease.
So we didn't get a lot of actual jumping through time, but we did get a lot of mysterious things on the island, because after Sawyer and Juliet escape the flaming arrows, they run into some people in army uniforms. One of them has a British accent, and thanks to Waspedia / fandom that involves DVDs, we could tell that their uniforms say Jones, Mattingly, and Cunningham on them. So Jones is the one who's doing all the talking, and he wants to know where they're from, and then who says they're going to cut off one of Juliet's hands just to show they're serious. Real classy move. But then they are rescued by the most murder-happy protagonist of this side of the time jump, John Locke, who strolls confidently out of the jungle, feeling much better after that bullet wound, I'm assuming, and back to his knife-throwing tricks. Yeah, really a reverse Naomi here, which is how he should have been introduced, in the good way. We're back to liking Locke, because we have to, right?
I never didn't like Locke.
He's definitely the protagonist of this scene.
I mean,
he saves
James
the day.
And Juliet. Yeah.
Right, and we definitely don't want James and Juliet to die. I can tell you that one 100%. Yeah. We want them to live on.
So, like, I mean, I'm sure. I'm sorry. What is the law firm name? Cunningham,
Mattingly and Jones.
Cunningham, Mattingly and Jones.
Yeah, the law offices of Cunningham, Mattingly and Jones. Like, maybe they're good guys. I don't know, but they're threatening like two of our faves. So of course we're on Team John. Of course we are.
Yeah, right? John would never cut someone's hand off just to show that he's serious.
Right. They try to Jamie Lannister her.
Right. Especially like. That just seems like a terrible negotiating tactic. Like, I'm going to start by cutting one arm off so that you know that I mean business. I don't know, man. Too much, whoever you are, British guy.
Take it off the top. Yeah, Mattingly and or Jones and or Cunningham, whichever one you are. Yeah.
But all this happens, and I don't believe we actually jump out of this time period that we're in island-wise. So after last episode's Skip-a-palooza, we get a tiny breather, but unfortunately that breather involves a mysterious flaming arrow assault. Let's check on some corners! Neil, we have a great Giacchino corner, I think, this week.
Yeah, this one comes in at the end of the episode, I believe. It's called, this is a track called The Swinging Pendulum. Very punny. He's getting warmed. We're only in episode two, so who even knows where we could go from here?
Season five, Giacchino is back. That season four finale really got him pumped.
Yeah.
He's ready to do it. Our jungle mystery moment, there are a lot, but in the jungle of mystery, we're going to stick with who are the British soldiers. We assume they're British. And soldiers because of uniforms and accents. Maybe that accent will come up later in the corners. We don't know.
Well, and we still don't know when are the British soldiers. Like, I think, you know, the camp is not there, obviously. We haven't flashed away yet. So we're still in some time period. And the camp is gone. There are people with flaming arrows. John's still there, which is good. But there doesn't seem to be anything about these soldiers that gives away their time period other than, you know, we know that it's before the flight A-15.
I really wish that Juliet had turned to James and John and been like, guys, when are we?
Yeah.
Lost.
Although I'm sure there's some smart, historically minded person
uniform
out there being like,
analyst.
I know exactly when that uniform and that gun is from, so yeah. good for you, you figured it out. But
email
the rest
us at hosts@stormpodcast.com.
The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award is gonna go this week to the Hot Pocket.
Mm-hmm. Hot Pocket.
Banks off a wall and goes down on the floor. Never
just
to
think,
come and return.
Think about the kind of day Hurley has had, like the tumultuous day that he has had protecting Saeed, doing some weekend at Hurley's. And the man hasn't eaten all day. And I've been there. I've been hangry before. You can imagine the frustration that is going to come when his mind snaps back and he's like, oh man, I forgot to eat anything. As he's being hauled off to jail. So you weep for the Hot Pocket. The Hot Pocket was Hurley's last chance to have a good meal before self-arresting.
I think it's really fun that, like, you know, I almost asked, like, everyone what their favorite lie of the episode was. Mine, for the record, is Dan coming out of the jungle being like, I lost my backpack, when, like, Dan's the worst liar in the history of the universe. Like, you have to, I like that, like, the whole episode, Hurley's like, can't lie anymore, lying's bad, can't lie, and then, like, he lies to get arrested, like, mm-hmm. he lies to save himself.
and the fact that he doesn't know how many people were murdered,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, I killed four, three, yeah, whatever. Three,
four, whatever,
whatever. Whatever you need. Also, it's interesting because, like, he gets two pieces of advice, right? Like, Saeed tells him, don't believe anything Ben says, don't go with him no matter what happens, and Dry Ghost Ana Lucia is like, don't get taken by the cops, whatever you do, oh my gosh. And Hurley's like weighing it up and he's like, oh, I'm gonna go with Saeed because he's very good. So
he's very good.
That's the advice I'm going with.
I have a Hot Pocket related question. This seems to happen to a lot in movies. I'm trying to think it's ever happened to me. Surely I've been this surprised, but have you ever just been so surprised to see someone you threw whatever you were holding at them?
I don't know. Like, I don't know that I would have gotten like the full trajectory. Like, I've flung things. It hasn't been a throw, but I'll like fling something in surprise and like fear. Yeah.
I've definitely dropped things in surprise. I don't know if I've ever like, I don't have, I, it's, there's some sort of reflex, I guess, that I don't have where I don't turn and throw things. But I've definitely been scared enough to like drop shit.
Yeah, I have a vague memory of being surprised enough in like my freshman year dorm room because you couldn't see the door if you were sitting at the desk to have flung a pen at somebody. But I can't like imagine holding food and being like, ah, and just like, oh my God, my Wheaties.
Can I tell you, or, like, whatever, can just... I tell you a story that's not going to be funny at all to you, but is very funny to me?
Mm-hmm.
Actually.
Sure.
I was playing, like, you know the game show, like, I forget what the dollar amount is, but the pyramid, right? Whatever it is, the
$10,000
pyramid. Yeah, $10,000 pyramid, right? Where you have to say a bunch of things. You have to say a bunch of things, and the person has to guess what the category is, right? But you can't say what the category is. That's the game. So we were playing. I was in the dorms, and I was playing like a sort of dorm game version of it, an at home version of it, and like you can't say what the category is. That's the rule. You can't say what the category is. And I was playing with this like real jerk. And he said flings from my Flometown. The category is things from my hometown. He said flings from my Flometown, which is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my entire life. And I think about it all the time. And I just need you to know that flings from my Flometown is in my head forever. All right. That's all.
All right.
You laughed anyway. Thanks.
The flings from my Flometown is like, it feels like one of those sex memoirs that I would love to read.
Flings from my Flometown.
I don't know what gender or if it's all genders, but I would like to figure out what the flings from the Flometown is. I'd be into it. All right, Accent Corner. Speaking of the British gentleman.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, it's my job, which is Accent Corner. We meet some soldiers, and one of them is like, extra, extra Chim Chim Chiru. And though he's not listed as either Cunningham Mattingly or Jones, LLC, he is listed as British guy in the credits. Do you have any guess whether this actor, whose name is Tom Connolly, is actually British? Because, when he's like, oi, tea and crumpets! what do you think, Neil?
I'm going to say yeah. Yeah, he's British. I mean, it's close.
All right, Dave, what do you think? When he goes, Mary Poppins, Chim Chim Chiru. Does that sound British to you?
I feel like you're trying to get me to tip in a direction to be correct, but I'm going to naturally fight that instinct and agree with Neil.
No, he is British.
He is British.
Hell yeah. He's just being like, yes! Like really extra British.
Fool us, Tom Connolly.
Yeah. So
he's just really trying to confuse the audience of what time period it is. He's like, he's doing some Dickensian accent. This will really throw him off.
Please, sir, can I have some more guns?
Yeah. Do you know where Tom Connolly's from?
Oh, where in the UK?
Is it because
no?
Is it because he had a Manchurian accent or Mancunian accent? Mancunian accent. And Jack Bender's like, no, not that. That's very specifically something in our fucking series.
My last name is.
And he's like,
Doric.
Well, then I could do chimney sweep. It would be like if somebody hired me to be like, do American, and then I do American, and they're like, oh no, we have someone from Colorado that's like, can you just be Southern? I'd be like, inoffensively.
That's a good question. I just don't have an answer for you because it was hard for me to find information on old Tom Connolly. In the first place, but I did get British, but he does not have like a full wiki or anything, so yeah,
maybe they just told him to go ham with the Dick Van Dyke and he was like, aye sir. Anyway, the Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, goes when Ben says to Hurley, if you come with me, you won't ever have to lie again. Which seems like a promise that Ben wouldn't make if it were true or ever.
Just seems like the kind of thing you should not believe if Ben Linus says it to you.
Yes. I think like absolutes from Ben Linus are probably always lies. No. It's time for a woo-loo-loo, the best time travel moment. I'm going to give it to Suddenly Flaming Arrows because Flaming Arrows as a projectile is a very good, we could be anywhere in time of humans having simple tools and fire. Ooh. So Suddenly Flaming Arrows is a great assault weapon when you don't know where you are in time.
Yeah. Dig also, having someone get hit with a flaming arrow right after they scream the word fire is a great way to kick off an action sequence.
That sounds like a Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award. We'll be going to Frogert, who says, we can't even get fire, hit by a flaming arrow. Ah! And then he's dead. Good old irony. Natural island irony. All right, it's time for the Jungle of Kistry, as you might have heard in our email that ended up being a review. This is our popular segment where we decide who needs to be kissing on this show filled with very attractive people and things. How did we do last week for our season 5 premiere, Joanna, because he left?
Okay, so because he left, where where I promised one of our listeners that I would not put Desmond and Penny in just to give her couple a chance, and it didn't work out very well anyway. So Sawyer's Bare Feet in the Jungle got only 14.6% of the vote, so apparently no one wants Sawyer to get a weird parasite from the jungle.
They also seem to have had some sort of terrible breakup this week in this week's episode where he gets stabbed by a stick.
You had 1 week to vote for Bare Feet in Jungle, and they didn't fall.
Yeah, never again.
Richard and Locke, 22.5% of the vote. Hurley and Saeed, 29.2% of the vote. But I guess you just can't even put Desmond at all in the poll because the constants, Desmond and Daniel, got 33.7% of the vote. So they are our winners, our time constants, our beard boys. So there
we'll have to test the Desmond theory again this week or something.
We can do that. I don't know. I see the writing on the wall for this week. Okay. So this week we have a few options. We've got Frogert and the Flaming Arrow. That's from our listener, Eastern Violet. I like that one a lot. As you know, I'm always a fan of inanimate objects in the poll. We've got James and Juliet from Tori. So our J names on the run in the jungle. We've got Son and Kate. That's from me. I just wanted them to, like, kiss in their hotel room and then, like, have vengeance on everyone together. Why not? And then our listener Bronwyn wrote in, and she wants Frank and Desmond, and her reasoning is when the episode opens, it opens on the beers, that the frosty beers that Frank gets out of the, like, yacht fridge. And he only brought two up to the survivors. And he gave his other one to Desmond. So it's Frank and Desmond. The chest boys is what I would call them. Ooh. Right? Aren't they? Chesty?
Yeah. They're definitely chest boys.
They both have their own brand of button watch that's worth keeping an eye on.
I feel like they both would enjoy Jimmy Buffett and a trip to Margaritaville. That's how I feel about Desmond and Frank. So, yeah. So there you go. James and Juliet, Frogger and the Flaming Arrow, Son and Kate, Frank and Desmond. You'll be able to vote over on Twitter at Storm Podcast. So submit your votes.
Oh, yeah. And this Flaming Arrow episode isn't over yet because we got one more corner, and it goes to Carl's Memorial Coming Right Now Act Break Award. And that goes to Sawyer, who says, run! And then flaming arrows fly around them. It's been a flaming arrow type of episode called The Lie. Could have been called The Flaming Arrow, I guess, but it would have been a lot less similar.
We're like, what's that? It's, I almost have it. Some way to combine Hot Pocket and Flaming Arrow. Some sort of fire type thing. Too hot to handle.
I mean, it's the hot projectile episode.
I feel like I so wish I could run a TV show with you guys just to have these arguments about what to call the episode. Too hot to handle. Hot projectiles.
Flings from my Flome Town.
Flings from my Flome Town. All right, guys, we're gonna be back talking about this episode in a more spoilery fashion right after this.
Now it's time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council Patreon subscribers, those folks who subscribe at the $10 level or above. They watch movies with us, they hang out with us, they do all kinds of things with us. They're the best. We got some newcomers, so let us start with them. I would like to thank Jack Sinclair, Jen Davis, Ole Ballman, Ramses Severiano, Catherine Altmeyer, Bryce Poles, Lauren Hunter, Laura Fairbanks, Sam, Danielle Wilkinson, Anja Susan Sennes, Diana Fisher, Sam Williams, Delia Vosch, Beth Weingarner, Mike Harris, Matthew Wilson, Grayson Owen, Guava Corvallis, and Emily Ann. Thank you all so much.
And I would like to add to that, thanks, Lauren Adams, Heather Carpenter, Caleb McKee, Aaron Shelley, Christy Rice, Jillian Walsh, Catherine, Stephanie Berman, Sarah Trites, Aaron Gowerick, Paula Silva, Nate, Allison Heishman, Andrew Bird, Kelsey Lee Measure, Alex, Matt Pilari, Peter Hobson, Lisa Romney, and Lawrence Medina. Thank you guys very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Serafina Cobine, Justin Way, Aubrey, Lorenzo Ciandra, Michelle Boucher, Amy Schreiner Thomas, Shannon Como, Scott McNeil, Monica Wolf, Jesse Baird, Fainting Violet, Andrea Rodriguez Garcia, Lindsay Mitchell Irnissi, Josh Kaluza, Lex Gernon, Sverir Sigfusson, Cam Lewis, Ryan James, Mitch, and Felidia Featherbottom. Thank you all so very much for being members of Small Council. Very fancy there.
I just laugh every time because I know who that is. That's not her name.
Wait, you're saying the Featherbottom family isn't donated? And we're back for the storm. The lock antagonist check-in has recently just been turned to the antagonist check-in. I'm going to go from our other notes here and ask Joanna, is Sun the antagonist in this episode?
No, but I think it would be so much interesting if she was. Like, Sun is not mad at Kate. She didn't send the lawyers. Like, she's actually just mad at... And I'm just like, I don't... It's not... I just think it would have been fun to have, like, schemey Sun.
Right.
Schemier, you know what I mean? Like, she gets some good moments, like telling her dad off and like stuff like that, but like, and she's a little like, there is a scene in season 6 where she whacks Ben on the back of the head with an oar and knocks him out, which is really fun, but like, I would like even more like Dark Sun. I would love that.
Yeah. More because, Breaking Bad.
So. Yeah, because like, she thinks her husband is dead. This is your storm reminder that we know Jin's not dead. We just have to pretend for a little while. But like, mm-hmm. you know, like I and then I think she does show up to the, we'll get there, but like, she does show up, I believe, with a gun to like the church parking lot to try to kill Ben or whatever. So like, there is some.
Yeah, she's really serious about the whole killing Ben thing.
But I would just like her to, I just think it would be more interesting for her to have been like really playing Kate in this scene. As you say, really Walter Whiting her or whatever. And she's not. But Yujin Kim is really capable of it. And I still get scared every time I watch that scene. I find it so terrifying. So, yeah. She's not, but she should be, is the answer. The end. Yes.
You did a good job in the calm section of this episode making me think I misremembered and Sun actually did send the lawyers. So I'm like, man, Joanna's really bringing this home. That was really creepy.
Oh. A couple times I definitely forget sometimes when I rewatch that episode. I'm like, wait, is Sun really mad at Kate? And then it's like, then I'm always disappointed to be like, oh, no, she's not. Not that I'm anti-Kate. I just think it would be fun. So that's all.
Something that I want to try to piece together also from this episode is Eloise says they have to get back in 70 hours or God help them all. Isn't getting them back still Man in Black's whole thing? Isn't this still the evil plan?
Maybe. I don't know who came up with this. You have to bring them all
back. They all have to go back?
Yeah.
I don't exactly know. I don't recall because I haven't done the full season 5 rewatch yet, or if it's even in season 5, or if it has to go back until we don't know until Jacob starts touching people in the incident. This has all been like a grand design.
I know what happened.
All right. Okay. What happened?
The Man in Black.
Oh. Yeah.
Pretending to be Walt types to Eloise Hawking through the Dharma computer. And says, must bring all back, even dead body, please. Baby can stay.
Dead bod, please.
Baby can stay.
Okay, so...
baby Penny, fine.
So we do get later in the season the reverse of the conversation that John and Richard have in the last episode, where it's Man in Black John Locke, who tells Richard to go over there and fix John, tell him that he has to bring everyone back, and that he has to die, right?
Yes. That's so, okay, so it is, 6.
It's future Man in Black who starts this whole thing of, like, they all need to come back.
Well, Man in Black is also the one who said he had to move the island.
So then how did John get that that message to Eloise?
Oh, that's a good question.
Through Ben? I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, does Ben decide that it needs to happen?
When Ben shows up to kill him, is that when Ben finds out they all have to go back? And maybe after Ben kills him, then he's like, dials up his old friend Eloise Hawking. He's like, hey.
I also think that there is an element of Ben having other reasons, obviously, that he needs to go back. Like, he wants to go back. And also, we find out at the end of the season that he needs to go back and be, like, judged. Right, by the island. So they may be slightly unrelated. Like, well, Ben has his own reasons to go back.
Ben might have his own reasons to get back, but if he finds out from John the method, if he's like, oh, it'll work for me to come back even though I'm exiled, if I get everyone to go back, I can just slip in under the radar. Great, I'll do that. So in my head it goes fake Locke to Richard, Richard to real Locke, real Locke to Ben, Ben to Eloise.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. That works.
And then Ben also.
It's just still the bad plan, which I think is great in terms of this rewatch. I forgot how deep the bad plan goes once you decide who's the smoke monster.
Yeah. Still also not entirely true either, because they don't bring everyone back. They don't bring Aaron. So I don't know what the rules are.
It sounds like Joanna's right, where it's like Ben thinks he could be the hot dog and the pig in the blanket. And
Ben is like, I'm baby Aaron.
I'm taking the Aaron spot.
Sorry. It's really funny. I mean, but then some other people, other people, Caesar and Alana, we'll get to all of those people is not a great moment in Lost, but they sneak in too. They're the other people.
Yeah. Well, and also we'll get to the confusing part where just Hurley, Jack, and Kate disappear off the plane and not everyone else does. Yeah. Okay. We'll get
there. You know why that happens. That happens so that we can keep Sun and Jin apart for another whole fucking season. Anyway, we'll get there. But what's interesting is that at this point, I was reading Jeff Jensen's recap. By the way, Jeff, love Jeff. Big fan. This is not individual to Jeff. Almost every recap I read from this era, the recapper says something where I'm like, I don't think you'd write that now. Jeff says, he's talking about Charlotte's time time disease. And he goes, sorry, Charlotte, the cosmos just isn't that into you. But she's a pretty girl, and so I hope I'm wrong. So, love you, Jeff, but too pretty to die is not my favorite take you've ever had. So, thanks.
Also, he just kept also doing, sadly,
but she's a girl,
not true.
So I hope. Yeah. She's a girl, so I hope she lives. I feel like Lost has, instilled that hope in people.
But he was wondering if taking John back to the island would resurrect him. And like, he's right in a certain extent, but like, there could be, I could see another version of the show where like, how healy is this island? It heals his legs. Will it heal his entire death situation? Maybe. I don't know. No is the answer, but you know. That was what Jeff was. He said, might Locke be born again once his corpse returned to the lame leg revival island? Recap writing is so weird.
Gotta come up with a whole bunch of nicknames for stuff and be clever, like sometimes really late at night.
Yeah, exactly. And then we should say that the real, like, I married her coincidence moment is, we didn't do the one that I wanted to do. Anyway, the calm we were going to say, the I married her coincidence moment, was that David Reyes was watching Exposé. But the real one is that Dan's mom is Eloise Hawking, which I guess we haven't, like, really figured out yet. That Eloise Hawking is real? That she's working with Ben?
There's only one family that insists whatever happened, and they are all related.
Except for Saeed. Except for Desmond, sorry. Saeed is very good. Whatever happened, except for Desmond. Yeah.
Except for Desmond.
Yep.
Yeah, that's all from one family. As a reminder, we don't figure out what happened to Rose and Bernard until the incident part one, which is part of why I chose the official podcast section that I did, because I don't want people thinking Rose and Bernard are dead.
Yeah.
That seems unfair.
One of the best reveals in the entire show, though. Is that Rosenberg fucked off to a cabin in the woods, and they're like, and then everyone else is like, join us, and they're like, no.
No.
So
we're fine. No. The last time we were all together, Frogert was yelling at me about not being able to make fire, and I'm a dentist. I don't need to put up with that shit.
No.
Do they also have Vincent, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, all right. So our the trio of people who stay on the island and we're totally fine with it have now separated from our Losties.
Mm-hmm.
Good to know. All right. Before we do emails, there's one more bullet point here that just says Widmore.
Well, I just wanted our Storm listeners to know that we know.
That we know who's behind the things.
Well, no, that's Chuck Widmore in the he's Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes, the British soldier.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're in 1954.
Yeah.
So.
Which we also know.
Yeah.
Yes.
The flaming arrows are a nice misdirection, because you're like, what in the prehistoric? And then, like, I mean.
Immediately
like,
guys with guns, so it's like, now it's
weird. I didn't want to, like, say that when you, but I, like, looking at them, they kind of look like they're from the 50s or 40s. Or maybe 60s, but they don't look more modern than that, and they don't look older than that.
Right,
so
yeah, they
you're
don't...
right to say, like, you can't, like, I mean, I'm sure there's someone who could, like, exactly pinpoint where they're from, but, like, you know.
There's, if I recall from Lostopedia correctly, there has been a British soldier era knife that I think was in, like, the tin at the Aero Station or something that somebody noticed, like, around the time when Goodwin was still alive. So I think they've hinted at some point that there were British soldiers on the island, which I think is the reason behind the uniform fake out here, as much as I could remember. But somebody
they're all military drag, all the others. They're like,
yes,
they've killed all the soldiers and then have decided to wear their corpses. Similarly to when they kill the Dharma Initiative.
As I say, this is what they did before they dressed up as like dirty people.
Well, no, there was a time when they dressed up as, like, hippie scientists, and then they were like, now it's time for dirt people era has begun, you know? They just, you know, they're forever camping or LARPing or whatever it is that they do.
Forever LARPing. The story of the other.
Not to mention the temple others. Okay, yes.
we'll get there, and Dojin's baseball and everything sometime in the future of Lost. All right, we have emails.
We have so many emails. All right, great. Let's do them. Let us start with me not having closed the tab, right? Nope, I didn't. All right. Let's start with Sean, who wrote in about this episode, episode 2, The Lie. He said, stormy theorizing. He said, Sean from Ireland. And then he said, go on, do your duty. Which is A, a nice Stannis line, and B, I think him giving me permission to do an Irish accent. But I'm not doing it. All right. Hey, guys. Sorry for the long essay, but I wanted to add further on Dave's reluctance with unified island rules and all the logical inconsistencies. I think the tidiest explanation for the ghost slash smokes monster rules is that it's the reversed. Ghosts need to be dead on island, and Smokey can be anyone who's dead. We know that. The Man in Black needed Locke's body returned not because of the rules, but because he needed a plausible explanation for why Locke is suddenly resurrected and on island, using obvious Jesus imagery to play into the destiny narrative he helped sell the characters and audience on. It also plays into his cynicism and the final rug pull of the season. The grand purpose that the characters must fulfill to return the island is just a long con by this nihilistic trickster. He created a chosen one slash destiny narrative for his pawns, making up religious-like rules to create a false sense of mythological importance. Some of the stuff we think doesn't add up could be chalked up to lies the Man in Black told. This strikes me as the intention of Man Behind the Curtain. Ben is being manipulated with the comforting form of his mother in the same episode that the Man in Black pretends to be Jacob in the cabin. It explains why the writers would have Alpert ask young Ben with concern if his mom died on island. Why bring that up unless they want us to consider she's something other than a ghost? Abiturno reinforces that Richard's wife can only be the monster because she died off island. It's what's so shattering about the season 5 finale. I mean, part of Abiturno. Let me just really quickly say, that's true of the first appearance of Richard's wife and Abiturno on the ship, but at the end of the episode when she's talking to him via Hurley, that's like real. Hurley, I think, can pull ghosts from wherever. His pocket ghost universe, if you will. Okay, anyway. It's what's so shattering about the season 5 finale. It both confirms that the Man of Faith was right, that there are supernatural forces guiding events, but reveals it's just the petty power play of two immortals. Seemingly all-knowing characters like Eloise, Ben, and Widmore were revealed to have barely understood the big picture beyond our main characters after the time travel shenanigans. Knowing the rules and the mysteries which we, the viewer, craved didn't truly help them or us better understand the island's nature. Similarly, I think it's easy for us fans to get confused or frustrated trying to make a logical sense of all the rules in island lore, which I feel contributed to people's disappointment that the series finale didn't answer enough. The writers themselves were playing fast and loose, and I think their biggest mistake was teasing the mysteries as puzzles to be solved, rather than letting it be a metaphorical 2001 slash Twin Peaks kind of thing. I can't stop thinking about their very early idea to have characters fight their evil doppelgangers. I didn't know that that was an idea. That's interesting.
I also laugh because, like, I've watched the 4-hour explaining Twin Peaks season 3 on YouTube in its entirety. Sorry, go ahead.
Similarly, I think it's easy for us fans to get confused or frustrated. I already read that part. Okay, like Dave said, the island probably shouldn't have many neat explanations because it's a strange cosmic unknown. We thought Jacob and the Man in Black were its gods, but they were just dudes, like Dave said. They were just dude making up rules for things they didn't fully understand, like the ghosts or the heart of the island. We ultimately,
you keep adding what Dave said into good points. That's fine.
We ultimately know as much as they did. Sorry, my cat is crawling all over the fucking keyboard. Sorry. Okay.
Bugs on team, as Dave said.
Oh my god, go away. Most of Lindelof's work is about how people deal with faith and the unexplainable. And he's talked about disliking stuff like the midichlorians for making the Star Wars mythology too literal. He prefers the why over the what or how. So my unifying theory is that the mythology, as we understand it, is some view of religion. People making connections and rules for things they can't explain and claiming they have all the answers where none exist. Whenever something doesn't add up, I remember that Jacob spent most of his life not knowing what electromagnetism or gravity is, so probably not the best source of info. All the best and alulu to you, Sean. So there we go. That's a great email, I think. Thoughts do you have?
I like it. I like that idea, and I agree with everything he says. I just apologize for the way I am, because I am the guy who watched the Twin Peaks video, and I'm definitely the guy who it during my confirmation would go through the Bible and be like, well, what is this act? Is this like a rule? Is this like something we mean? Is this like a metaphor? So that's just my way of interrogating the unknown, is trying to like throw some facts around it. But then every once in a while, you know, I take some mushrooms and I'm just like, just put good in the world. So maybe I should be more like the mushroom Dave and less the podcast Dave.
It's like when you created Tomato God, Mushroom Dave.
The Tomato God.
Neil, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's a great email, and I can't do any better than Mushroom Dave.
So. I really do love that idea of like Ben and Winmore and Eloise all like having these like really strong ideas and being ultimately in the dark and wrong. And that even, you know, we've talked about this before, this idea of like Jacob and the Man in Black being these island gods, but ultimately really just being petty men, which we'll talk to, I'm sure, a lot more in Across the Sea. But, you know, this idea that Jacob is like really fallible and ignorant about a lot of things.
Like is on Parler fallible.
Yeah. The actor's on Parler.
just get ready for that tidbit as we get to him coming up in the incident.
Jacob survived the island to have some bad takes.
Supernatural ended just in time, so we don't have to deal with Mark Pellegrino anymore. Okay. This email comes from Michael and is titled Stormy Email About Juliet, Kate, Charlotte, and Fridging. Hi, Joanna, Dave, and Neil. My name is Michael, longtime listener, first-time emailer. First off, I want to say thank you for providing me and so many others with a much-needed escape from reality right now. Your podcast is always a highlight of my week. I'm emailing with more on the fridging discussion and Kate and Juliet's dynamic, which you discussed during last week's storm section. I have to respectfully and strongly disagree with the listener who argued that Kate willingly allows Juliet to die in the season finale. Although, don't...
I remember that email all of a sudden.
Although we don't get to see them interact a ton this season, I love the interactions we do see, and I believe all their moments together demonstrate how much respect they've developed for each other. I think it's a bit reductive to refer to Juliet as Kate's adversary, especially at this point in the series. In season 4, we see Juliet offer an olive branch of sort to Kate while she's stitching up Jack's post-appendectomy. And this felt to me like growth for the characters and especially the writers who finally stopped with the petty squabbling around the love square that we saw a lot of in season 3. Later this season, we see Juliet and Kate share some friendly banter and work together on multiple occasions. In the season finale, Kate tries desperately to save Juliet from falling down the pit and yells to get Sawyer's attention. But from my point of view, there is absolutely no way she could have reached the chains wrapped around Juliet's legs without falling down the shaft herself. In the following episode, Kate is the first to hear Juliet calling for help and immediately starts digging through the swan debris. After Juliet's death, we get that beautiful scene of Sawyer and Kate crying. Oh my god, I just almost started crying thinking about that scene. Oh no! Alright. Beautiful scene of Sawyer and Kate crying on the docks, and I think Kate is truly mourning Juliet with him. Sorry for going into so much detail, I just have a lot of love for these characters and I enjoyed their dynamic going forward. I think that if Juliet had survived the series, they could have been great friends / girl gang pals. I think Lost has a lot of really compelling female characters, which makes it even more upsetting when those characters are fridged. Alex's death is undoubtedly an example. I find Charlotte's death really frustrating in the same way Libby's is, because both characters had a lot of untapped potential. We never get a proper Charlotte backstory, nor does she get any inkling of her own arc / development. Her death provides an emotional beat for Daniel and little else, so in my view, that's fridging. However, I think that Juliet's death is a very different case. Juliet is my favorite character on Lost, and while I don't think she needed to die, I certainly wish she hadn't. I think her death is incredibly emotionally impactful and signifies a pretty major turning point for the series. We know a lot about Juliet. We've seen her backstory explored. We understand who she is, and we watch her develop throughout the series. Though I wish we had more focus on her this season, I do appreciate that Juliet is pretty much driving the action, at least in the 1970s plotline, throughout the two-part finale. She is the one who leads the great sub-escape and decides to return to the island. She ultimately makes a decision to help Jack on his mission to set off Jughead and leads the others to his aid in the shootout at the Swan. Juliet's death is tragic in a similar way to Rousseau's for the reasons Joanna previously put forward. After trying to escape the island for so long, Juliet was so close, but she decided to return. Sawyer blames Jack for Juliet's death, but really it is no one's fault, except for maybe the island, aka the ultimate bad dad. Just like Rousseau, Juliet's decision to get involved, which Rose and Bernard opt not to do in the very same episode, leading to their survival, leads to her tragic demise. Her death upon her setting off the bomb unsticks our character in time and finally places everyone in the present day, allowing for season six to happen the way it does. I think that Juliet's death is up there with Locke's for having the biggest impact not only on many characters, but on the overall plot, and therefore cementing them as integral players in the Lost mythos. Of course, this is all just one opinion, and I would love to hear your thoughts. Apologies for the long email. Thanks so much. You rock. Best wishes, Michael. So, I will just say really quickly, I love this email, but I will say really quickly, I do want us to keep an eye on when Kate returns. I agree with a lot of that, but I think it's missing this aspect of the season that I don't love, which is, like, as soon as Kate returns, Juliet does get really jealous of her, and that's also partially Sawyer's fault, because Sawyer keeps, like, sending these, like, basically, the love triangle rears its ugly head again. Yeah. It's not
the love.
Not great.
The love quadrangle definitely yeah. doesn't go away in season five. But I will say this. I liked all those points, and my reading on Juliet's death at the end is more of like a, it's a kind of a heroic thing, right? Because what she believes when she's down there hitting a nuclear weapon with a rock is that she's saving everyone and, you know, resetting even her own storyline. So the Kate thing last week was an interesting take, but I guess I never would have arrived there, because by the end of season five, it's like Juliet giving up the life that she really wanted to have with Sawyer and making this heroic act, that she believes is going to save all of these people is, it's definitely not an antagonist moment. It's a protagonist move, I believe.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
I think right or wrong, last week's email just got a gold star from me for being like, you're going to tell me the one time Kate has to climb, she's not going to climb? Because yes.
I mean, that is a good point. But, I think Juliet was, she's thinking heroic move here. And Kate is, Kate's just reacting,
All right. We have one more email that I'd love to read, but it's a Pat email. And so, it's long. Are you guys ready for
Sir Pat? Let's do it.
All right.
Pat.
Last email, Pat. Dear Oceanic 3. since Joanna has on occasion commented on how she wished Desmond's story on Lost ended with him living his best life with Penny after season 4, I wanted to write in defense of latter season Desmond. Before I do that, I have to ramble on a bit, and I must apologize for that. The Lost Island is indeed an island of mystery. And if we take Jacob's extremely simple analogy to Richard, it's a metaphysical cork that keeps evil trapped in a metaphysical bottle, the way an actual cork keeps wine from escaping a bottle. Honestly, it's more accurate to say that the bottle is what's keeping the wine contained and the cork controls access to the wine, but no analogy is perfect. Ignoring Jacob's evil label of the wine in the analogy, the island seems to be an access way to something metaphysical. This something seems to have a kind of sentience and agency when we refer to the island wanting something or as causing something to happen. It's the metaphysical sentience that we mean. This presence is sometimes represented by Christian Shepherd, who talks to Jack in the season finale when it's revealed that Jack and his close island connected associates have been existing in a metaphysical other space, a timeless void of consciousness where they have the opportunity to find closure and move on to what's next. In season 6, Desmond is instrumental to the plotline of the other characters in this flash sideways universe, where he shakes his fellows out of the realm of lost opportunities and paths not taken. Desmond can do this because among the cast of Lost, he's the one who had his story nicely wrapped up when he was reunited with Penny. The sideways universe still has its temptation for him in the form of a paternal and accepting Charles Widmore, but compared to his satisfying relationship with Penny, despite Widmore's objections, the flash sideways is just a weak distraction to our handsome Scott. I'm not sure who among the cast would be a good substitute for Desmond in this role. And sure, they could have done things with Electra Walt or Ghost Michael or, Libby, just to try to either give those characters some more meat on their overall stories, or in the case of Libby, bring back a fan favorite gone too soon. But I find Desmond's inclusion very satisfying, particularly in regards to his special nature. He survived the electromagnetic event of the hatch explosion. He was granted visions of the future, which seems reasonable, since his consciousness was exposed to the timeless metaphysical realm that the island is the cork for. He survived being unstuck in time instead of succumbing to the time disease. Desmond is the go-to guy for weirdness, and if he settled down quietly for his best life with Penny after season four, it would really be a lost opportunity of a lost established opportunity. There's a lowercase lost and an uppercase lost in that sentence. I also appreciate Desmond's time on island in season six, but unfortunately have not rewatched the season after it aired. I don't want to spin up too many things about it. I seem to recollect that Desmond, after he gets zapped by Whismore, is no longer Desmond, but a serene, otherworldly observer who is disconcerting to the Man in Black. It's true, and he like spends a lot of time down a well. It's like, not happy. Okay, that was me. I propose that during this time, Desmond's consciousness is now busy in the timeless flash sideways, helping his friends, our losties who can be there and also alive on the island, because time has no meaning when a timeless void is introduced. I appreciate the concern this brings to the Man in Black, because it highlights that just like our losties had no idea what was going on in regard to the others, and just like the others didn't necessarily know the full truth that they were part of some game between feuding super beings, the Man in Black did not understand what was going on in regards to the otherworldly sentience of the island, which exists beyond the supernatural aspects of both Jacob and his brother. Much like John Locke came face to face with the smoke monster and mistook it for the heart of the island, the dark analog of John Locke is face to face with an extension of the great mystery of the island, and he doesn't understand it. This email is long, so I'll stop here, but I'll eventually try to write up some stuff on Man of Faith, Man of Science, Plato's Cave, and how all the rules on Lost are either derived by observation or taken from some higher knowledge authority who might be unreliable. Take care. Be very well. Stay safe. I haven't fallen down yet in 2021. Pat.
Yeah.
So a great Pat email and a nice companion to that other email that's like, Jacob and the Man in Black don't know shit.
They don't know what's going on. No one knows shit about Desmond.
Yeah, these tears.
He's the Weller man.
These tears of misunderstanding. And I kind of feel that. I do. I think that, I mean, basically what happens in the like sideways world wake up story is that everyone wakes up basically when they meet their like, they connect to their soulmate, kind of, is mm-hmm. what it is. And actually,
they meet their constant.
Yeah, and actually Charlie goes first, mostly. Like, Charlie doesn't get the full wake-up, but Charlie gets the half wake-up when he sees Claire. And then Charlie is the one who sort of tries to wake Desmond up by, like, trying to kill him. I don't know, it's complicated. We'll talk about when we get there. But, like, certainly they've established Desmond as, like, a whatever happened to happen except for Desmond. So if you're going to send anyone, like, careening between realities and life and death and whatever, then it should be Desmond. I think it's just tough when you've established this character as like, I don't know. I'm half convinced by Pat's email, but give me some time and maybe I'll become full convinced. I still think it's faulty the way that they use him, but
yeah. Pat's email feels emotionally right, but unfortunately, Lost allows its plot to leave its characters behind, so it's not fully right, right, Joanna?
How dare you!
All right, man. I'm looking forward to Pat bringing Plato's allegory of the cave into Lost, because why the fuck not? That allegory is great.
Oh, those were all great storm emails, by the way. Keep them up. They really help our storm section like be a lot healthier than like, we knew it was Whismore, don't worry. So thank you guys so much for those storm emails. They're great. Keep them coming. Please continue to come up with theories about who else Kate might have killed on the island. Low tier.
When Kate did not climb, part two. All right, until next week, I'm sorry. I don't even know what's happening next week. Neil, what's happening next week on Lost?
Oh, well, next week we're going to get more Desmond stuff in an episode called Jughead, which if you're Stormy, you know that means a bomb. The bomb.
Yeah.
And it's going to be fun. We also get another baby next week.
Excellent.
Sorry, I just always mistakenly thought that Jughead was like a common term for a bomb. I don't know, until I googled it today, and like hits on Jughead and bomb only give you Lost. So
So maybe it's just a specific Lost thing.
Maybe it just is an Archie reference and that's it.
Until next week's Riverdale crossover, as I mentioned, we will be around the internet and attempting to avoid another violent coup attempt. Where could people find more of your work around online if you would like them to? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on VanityFair.com. I will have a lot of WandaVision content coming, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Rothis.
Oh, yeah. Before Neil, is there another podcast you want to plug right now?
Sure, but only people who know who likes Lost spoilers can know about my other projects. Yeah, I do a podcast for Vanity Fair called Still Watching with Richard Lawson, and we're bringing in an extra person in the form of Anthony Bresnikan, and we're doing a three-hander coverage of WandaVision starting Friday. We have interviews. First interview that we're starting with is Kevin Feige, and it just goes from there. So join us for WandaVision, where we're going to be doing like, it's basically like the Thought Bubble, where like we used to do like in expert versus expert sections, or actually it's kind of like a calm and a storm. Basically, Richard and I will be doing the calm section and Anthony and I will be doing the storm section of that podcast. So there you go.
I feel like that's an excellent way to cover any sort of television. Don't you think, Neil?
Oh yeah, I agree for sure.
Perfect. Calm it up, storm it up. WandaVision this Friday. Neil, where can people find more of your work online?
Well, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com. You can get me on Twitter at OnePerfectShot or at Rejects. I might tweet about WandaVision as soon as I can see it, which I think is just Friday. But you're also, if you are a member of our Patreon, Slack, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, jump into the Slack, jump into Stream Together, Watch Alone. We are about to finish season one of Deadwood and move on to, you guessed it, season two of Deadwood. We're watching it every day. Join us. It's been fun and interesting and vulgar.
Ooh, very vulgar. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where this week we released our big top tens episode. So if you are looking for something to watch or stream, with the exception of Minari, you could see all of these movies. So go ahead and check out that podcast if that's your flavor of stuff. If not, good luck, Americans. Hey, world, there's still the virus. Wash your hands. And everybody, don't fall down.
Don't fall down, America.